We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana.
It's 1 o'clock, Champaign, Urbana. Time to jump. It's Media Matters here in WILL AM 580. The question many people think about is, who's the most dangerous man in America? Well, our guest today will have his answer to that question based on a new book he's just written, Rush Limbaugh's Assault on Reason, The Most Dangerous Man in America. We'll be joined by John K. Wilson today for the full hour, so please join us. But before we go to our guest, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
After years of slashing budgets and cutting staff in newsrooms across the country, it's good to hear that at least one local TV broadcaster is finally building up its news division. The New York Times reported that KSDK-TV in St. Louis is adding newscasts, hiring staff, and buying new production equipment. But are more journalists going to be doing investigative reporting? The Times didn't mention whether actual reporters are being hired. Josh Stearns of Free Press says the Times story isn't necessarily cause to celebrate.
Well, I wish that the expansion of journalism that we're seeing in St. Louis was the whole picture, but it's really not the whole picture. What we're seeing is one station that happens to be adding a couple extra hours of news to the early mornings and late evenings, but we don't know how much of that is recycled from other newscasts and how much of that is also being shown on other stations.
As it turns out, KSDK, an NBC affiliate, is also producing news for ABC affiliate KDNL.
ABC has quietly signed away control of part of its newsroom to the local NBC station, to one of its competitors, which means fewer journalists on the ground, fewer diverse voices, and a lot less news in a town that's supposed to be seeing an increase in news.
This covert consolidation is also happening with the local Fox and CW affiliate in St. Louis. KTVI Fox 2 is producing local newscasts for KPLR 11. So the largest urban area in Missouri is actually getting less news reported by fewer journalists, leaving many stories untold and many voices unheard. The Federal Communications Commission has rules against media consolidation to keep competition and diversity in local news. But these shared service deals circumvent those rules. Covert consolidation is now happening in 100 cities across the country. It would seem that the FCC would be furious with these efforts to undermine the spirit of its regulations against consolidation.
So far, we just haven't seen that level of anger from the FCC. However, now is a great time to start getting involved in this issue because the FCC is reviewing all of their media ownership rules this fall. So what we're trying to do is to make sure that this issue of covert consolidation, like what's happening in St. Louis, is a central issue in the FCC's ownership review and that we make sure that the FCC responds.
For more information about covert consolidation and to find out if it's happening in your area, go to savethenews.org.
One thing to note right up front is that there are two copyrights in music.
Casey Ray Hunter is the deputy director of the Future of Music Coalition, a nonprofit organization that focuses on policies affecting musicians and their fans. And thanks to a little-known copyright provision put into place in the 1970s, the policy arena is set to shake up the music industry significantly in the coming years.
So there's the composition copyright. You can think of notes on paper for that. And then there's the sound copyright, which is more like music captured on tape or hard drive.
This sound copyright was traditionally held by labels and publishers, who then in turn did the work of getting the music out to the broader public. Back in the days before high-speed internet, home recording, and DIY publishing, labels and publishers were crucial if an artist wanted to reach an audience. But in the late 1970s, Congress overhauled copyright laws, creating a provision that returned the sound copyright to its original owners after 35 years.
The law went into effect in 1978, and that's when the clock started ticking. So what we're seeing now is a whole host of works that are eligible to revert back to their creators. So basically anything that was created after January 1, 1978 is fair game for what is called termination of transfer. And it sounds kind of like heavy and sinister, but it's actually a good thing for artists.
This transfer doesn't happen automatically. Artists have to file their intent to reclaim ownership 2 years before the deadline with the Copyright Office. And once the songs have been officially deemed eligible, they have 5 years to file another claim to actually get the rights.
Now, obviously, the companies that currently control these copyrights aren't in any hurry to give them back. But we think it's important for creators to have another bite at the apple, so to speak, because when you look at the history of the music industry, you hear all these stories about bad contracts where artists never made any money, particularly on the sound copyright side. And this would give them another opportunity. And even if they decide to re-grant their works to a label, the same label or a different label, they might have more leverage than the first time around. Obviously, no single approach is going to be appropriate for every single artist, but we think it's crucial that the artists get to exercise their rights as Congress intended.
Not surprisingly, labels and publishers, who have made tens of millions off of these songs, are reluctant to relinquish these rights in the first place. As the clock continues to count down, this debate will likely heat up. You can follow Future of Music at futureofmusic.org for more details as it develops.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, August 28th, 2011, here on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today is someone who's been on our show a few other times. He's an author of five other books, and he'll be talking about his brand new book. John K. Wilson is also the editor of the Illinois Academe, which is the publication of the Illinois branch of the American Association of University Pressers. He is an Illinoisan through and through. His new book, which we're talking about today, is The Most Dangerous Man in America, Rush Limbaugh's Assault on Reason. John Wilson, thank you for taking time from your schedule to join us.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, let's dive right in, John Wilson, on this book. There have been, I think, a lot of books written about Rush Limbaugh. I must say I'm not sure of how many. I know of at least one or two. Why did you decide to write one, and what do you think you can add to the mix with this book?
Well, the reason why I wanted to write about Limbaugh is because I think he is so important to our current media landscape, as well as our current political situation. And he really is the biggest voice in the conservative movement, as well as in conservative media. He is the biggest audience in radio, and he's had an enormous impact. Really, if you look at how the country has changed, how the media landscape has changed in the last two decades, he shares a lot of what I think is the blame, some people would say the credit, for making these changes, because he really inspired a lot of what we now take to be just fundamental parts of the media today, things like talk radio, conservative talk radio, Fox News Channel. All of these things didn't exist when he started, and it really was his success and his influence that made all of these kind of imitators possible. And, you know, Roger Ailes, who created Fox News Channel, was the producer of Rush Limbaugh's talk show for a few years in the early 1990s before Fox News Channel started. And so it really is that kind of direct influence that Rush Limbaugh has. And it's been an enormous influence, I think, on the Republican Party, that you've seen this radical shift to the right in the Republican Party, I think is much to the credit of what Rush Limbaugh and the other people in Fox News Channel and talk radio have really done to push a right-wing agenda on the Republican Party and on American politics.
John Wilson, you know, I just had a chance to read this book, and I was impressed by the extent to which you familiarized yourself with Rush Limbaugh's work. Did you, to research this, did you basically listen to a gazillion hours of Rush Limbaugh's radio program?
Well, I've actually listened to Rush Limbaugh off and on for many years. I have sort of a fascination with right-wing talk radio in many ways. But a lot of what was in the book, I actually, when I was writing the book, I actually probably listened to Rush Limbaugh a little less than I normally did, because he does post transcripts of pretty much everything that's on his program on his website every day after the show. And I wanted to be, in this book, I wanted to be very well documented. And so I relied on, for the most part, on what Rush Limbaugh transcripts on his website rather than what I, you know, was writing down of what he was saying on his show. My attempt was to really document this thoroughly and to make it so that when I have a point to make, you know, people can go to Rush Limbaugh's website and see that he did indeed say exactly what I have in the book. And so there's almost 2,000 footnotes in the book, and enormous number of them are to Rush Limbaugh's direct words.
I remember that one of the first times I listened to Rush Limbaugh was probably in the early 1990s. And I don't listen to a lot of AM radio unless I'm in my car. And so if I'm not, and I have children then who didn't like to listen to talk radio at all, no matter what it was. So it was rare to get a chance. And I finally was alone in the car and driving. I listened to Rush Limbaugh during the day. And it was an extraordinary experience, having only heard about him for the most part, or heard just clips of him, but not heard him for an extended period, because this was when there was a huge debate over the rising levels of CEO salaries and how they were much greater than the salaries of the average worker in America. And early in the Clinton administration, there was a movement afoot to not let corporations deduct CEO salaries above a certain amount, like $1 million. You know, so if you wanted to pay your CEO $10 million, only the first million was a tax-deductible business expense. And this happened the day, this was hitting the news the day that I listened to Rush Limbaugh. And I listened to him talk about this issue for 5 or 10 minutes. And needless to say, he was opposed to any, thing that would hurt rich people. So he was all in favor of, opposed to having the government do this. And after listening to this guy for 5 or 10 minutes, you know, I almost thought they were going to come take my money away if the government got away with this. I was deeply impressed with his ability as a communicator. And I haven't listened to him a whole lot since then. Was that just, did I hit him on a hot day, or does he have skills in this area?
Well, no, he is very skilled in many ways. He is a good communicator. One of the things he brought to talk radio was bringing more humor into it. He often plays parody songs that are made for him. These kind of things that he brought from, remember, he started off, just to let you know, as a DJ. That was his goal in life. He dropped out of college. He hated school. The one thing he always wanted to be was a DJ. And so starting as a teenager, he was working in the radio industry. And really, that was his love. And so he brings a lot of traditions of AM radio DJs like Larry Dujack and these kind of things. The use of humor, the use of, he has all kinds of nicknames for his political enemies that he uses. You know, in many ways, to me, and I think to a lot of younger people, he's not really very funny. He's not very entertaining. He's kind of what people who thought was funny and who were listening to DJs in the 60s and 70s in some ways, that it wasn't what today's humor, kind of Jon Stewart biting political satire so much, as it is a more of an older generation's kind of humor. And he really does have a good talent at bringing up the news of the day and sort of converting it and bringing the kind of what the conservative line should be about it. And so he's been very effective in shaping public opinion, particularly among conservatives, by doing that.
Our guest, John K. Wilson, author of the new book, The Most Dangerous Man in America, Rush Limbaugh's Assault on Reason, The book is published by Thomas Dunn Books, which is part of St. Martin's Press. Just published this year, as I said, it's out in cloth. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. John Wilson, based in Illinois, is the editor of the Illinois Academe, which is the publication of the Illinois branch of the American Association of University Professors, author of many other books. He's been on the show a lot. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for John Wilson, the number here at WILL is 217-333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And I suspect we have some listeners who know all about Limbaugh. I'm sure everyone does, but many who might not listen to him that often or be very familiar with the extent of his empire, John Wilson. Could you just give an outline of how many stations he's on, how big his listenership is, before, you know, just the raw numbers, so we get a sense of what we're talking about?
Well, I actually don't know precisely how many stations he's on. He's on an enormous number of small rural stations.
I mean, he's accessible everywhere in the country, pretty much, though,
isn't he? Yeah, he is the one voice you can hear from 11 to 2 weekdays, practically everywhere across the country, and that was probably because a lot of the arrangements, although he gets paid very well in some of the urban areas, most of the arrangements with the smaller stations across the country are kind of a timeshare, of where half of the advertising time goes to him to sell and his company, and half is with the local station. So that's where he draws a lot of the listenership and that is from the fact that he's so pervasive, that he's, you know, it's almost impossible to hear progressive talk radio in most parts of the country, but it's almost impossible to get away from Rush Limbaugh. And the estimates of radio listenership are not precise, but in general, the industry puts his weekly audience at about 20 million people. And, of course, they're not listening all at the same time, but he probably does have a listenership of about 4 to 5 million at any particular moment.
And what do we know about the demographics of the people who are regular Rush Limbaugh listeners? Are they sort of cross-section of Americans?
No. They're nowhere near a cross-section. They tend to be overwhelmingly male, almost entirely white, and they tend to be old. They're much older than the average radio listener. So he is not very good at reaching out to a younger generation in terms of who's listening to Rush Limbaugh. So those kind of and they really do match in some ways a lot of the demographics of the Republican Party to a more extreme degree, perhaps. But those are the people listening to Rush Limbaugh, and they do tend, of course, to be overwhelmingly conservative.
And they tend to vote too, don't they?
Well, yes. Again, the people who tend to be fairly wealthy, who tend to be older, are going to be the ones more likely to vote, actually. And these, of course, tend to be political activists, so they're even more likely to vote. And Limbaugh has a very important role within the Republican Party of in many ways trying to decide who is the real Republican, who is a real conservative, and he was really, in many ways, instrumental in sort of confirming that George W. Bush was a conservative and going after him. But he doesn't have absolute power. For example, he despises John McCain, and despite his efforts, John McCain was the Republican nominee in 2008. So it really is a question of what Rush Limbaugh's influence is. Even though he has enormous influence over the Republican Party and the conservative movement, he really doesn't reflect the mainstream of even the Republican Party in many ways.
John Wilson, what you refer to this in your book, and I'm still an issue I have trouble figuring out with Rush Limbaugh is his connection to the Christian cultural conservatives, evangelical conservatives. And I ask this because the few times I've heard him and what I've seen in your book, I mean, this is a person who is not someone I would confuse for being pious, to put it mildly.
No, and he really does not talk very much about religion at all. And certainly doesn't talk about it personally, and he puts himself out as a Christian, but he doesn't really talk at all about that on the show, and so he is not in any way like the Pat Robertson wing of the movement, where citing Bible verses or anything like that. That is absolutely not Rush Limbaugh. And part of that is, I think, an economic consideration of trying to reach out to a broader audience. But I think a lot of it reflects his own personal values, that he is a conservative at the core, but he's really not a deeply religious conservative.
How about the Tea Party? What is the nature of his relationship with that movement?
Well, I think his role in that is more as an inspiration. I think he wasn't involved really in organizing any events or anything like that, and he wasn't early on even a particular advocate of the Tea Party. But he is someone whose values certainly reflect the right wing of the Republican Party, which is what the Tea Party movement is all about. And so he really is kind of a guiding light for the Tea Party, but, you know, he doesn't really have a direct influence over what the Tea Party is doing. What he is most important, most devoted to, really, is the Republican Party. He is a very strong defender of the Republican Party and very much opposed to any sort of third-party movement on the right. And he is someone, you know, who has these very strong connections with Republican presidents for years now. George Herbert Walker Bush, invited him to the White House and took his bags up to his room in the White House. Mm. George W. Bush brought him a birthday cake in January of 2009, shortly before he left office, again in the White House. You know, and he's had presidents and ex-presidents call him on the phone to wish him a happy birthday and all these kinds of things. He is deeply influential and deeply connected within the mainstream of the Republican Party. And during any election, you'll find him campaigning in some cases for Republicans, having them on his show. He has these very strong connections with the Republican Party, even while he's sometimes critical of the Republican establishment for not being conservative enough.
Our guest, John K. Wilson, author of the new book, The Most Dangerous Man in America, Rush Limbaugh's Assault on Reason, just published by Thomas Dunn Books. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. We're coming live to you on WILL today, August 28th, 2011. The phone lines are open at 217-333-9455 and our toll-free line at 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines right now to our first caller. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with John Wilson.
I find this really unique. I work for a place where I'm privy to seeing a lot of Rush Limbaugh's magazine, the Limbaugh Letter, come through on a fairly consistent basis. And you were talking about him not being very Christian or very religious. Per se. I definitely agree with that, and I think from seeing this magazine that comes through constantly, I think he's such a narcissist. I think that he is just, he really thinks and personifies himself as being kind of like the Messiah for the Republican Party. Just seeing some of the stuff that he's had written on, you know, the back page of the magazine, you know, a lot of things where his word is right, you know, pictures of him where he is dressed up like George Washington, you know, like one of the founding fathers, you know, certainly lots of pictures of him just gloating and being very looking very self-righteous, and, you know, always pictures of Democrats looking forlorn and sad and ridiculous or whatever. So I think he's got this huge narcissistic streak that I think that fuels all this. You know, I certainly think that's why he is as popular as he is, because that's, you know, it's a very self-centered, very egotistical view of the world, and I think that there's plenty of guys. I know quite a few who love him, and they're in their, mid to late 40s, some of them in their early 50s, and they absolutely think that he is the best thing since sliced bread.
Well, caller, thank you very much for your comments. And that does relate to material, John Wilson, you have in the book, Rush Limbaugh, Narcissist in Chief.
Well, yes, he does have a very big ego, and some of it may be a radio persona kind of thing. I think a lot of it is very real, that he thinks that he's brilliant and that he's always right. One of the things I write about in the book is that he often comes on the show and says that he's been documented to be almost always right 99.6% of the time. And it turns out that is all fake. He has this fake company that supposedly does surveys of the accuracy of his opinions, which is all, as I talk about in the book, something he just makes up. And in fact, recently, earlier this year, he was actually on the phone with a 13-year-old kid who had called into the show and was asking him questions because she had heard that he was 99.6% right, and he confirmed that. And of course, a lot of Rush's listeners aren't aware that all of that is just a totally fabricated claim. But it is certainly true that if you look at the covers of the Limbaugh Letter, which is this magazine, it's not available online. It's only available in print. He charges about $50 a year for a monthly that's about 12 pages long. And so he makes a lot of money selling his fans what are basically his recycled monologues and a few interviews and other things thrown in. But he always has himself on the cover of the Limbaugh Letter. And actually, the most recent issue has him on the cover as a wealthy homeowner who discovers a burglar in his home. And the burglar sacking his home is Barack Obama on the cover of the current issue. Which was a kind of image that actually persuaded a Republican, black Republican, who I have been trying to convince for years and who have been defending Rush Limbaugh, convinced this Republican, whose name is D.R. Tucker, that this is really a racist image and that Rush Limbaugh is, in fact, pushing this racist viewpoint. So this kind of cover imagery that focuses on attacking Obama, attacking his enemies, but most of all pushing Rush Limbaugh forward as a kind of conservative messiah for the movement.
John Wilson, you raised the issue of race and Rush Limbaugh's attitudes towards race and frequent charges that he is a racist. And you have plenty of documentation in the book, some of his quotes. And I think, to be charitable, they're the sort of quotes you would hear white people say in bars maybe 40 years ago. That's the caliber of discussion for the most part. But what's your... Give me your take. Well, I mean, what is your sense of how Rush Limbaugh regards the issue of race and racism in the United States today?
Well, and Rush is very defensive on this point, and there have been many incidents in his past where there's issues of race that have been brought up and questions of racism. But particularly when Barack Obama ran for president and since then, Rush Limbaugh has really intensified this kind of strange racial language, whether it's referring to Obama as little black man child or talking about in detail, as he did in 2008, claiming that Barack Obama wasn't, his heritage wasn't African, that it was Arab, which is a particularly odd kind of racial obsession, or ranging on things that Obama's policies are reparations for slavery, all of these kind of racial code language, in some cases not very well coded, are one of the things that Limbaugh invokes frequently. And there's always a question as to whether he's doing it because he's racist or whether he's doing it because it appeals to the racism of his audience. And that's, of course, very hard to know. You can never really know what Rush Limbaugh thinks. I'm not sure it particularly matters. The point is that the rhetoric and the imagery that Limbaugh invokes is racist. And I think I certainly document that fully in a chapter in my book, and I would certainly love to have conservatives and Republicans try to refute that and talk about it, but it really is an issue that that I think a lot of conservatives don't want to talk about.
You know, John Wilson, on this point, many African Americans I know, if not all of them, they hear that dog whistle when they hear Rush Limbaugh. They pick up on the sentiment really quickly. It's not, to most of them, it's like your friend you just converted. It's the terminology, the way it's said, the tone is something that's deeply embedded in sort of the racist culture in their view. So it's nothing new to them. And one of the things that was striking for a lot of Americans was, as you know, several years ago, Rush Limbaugh was thinking about buying a National Football League team because he's a big football freak. And basically the black players in the NFL said, you buy a team, pal, none of us are going to play for you.
Yeah, and that was the controversy over Donovan McNabb and his comments that Donovan McNabb only got positive coverage because journalists wanted a black quarterback to succeed. And the key problem I have with that is that it's factually inaccurate. There were various studies made actually of media coverage, and there's absolutely no evidence that media is favorable to black quarterbacks, even in more recent years. Certainly, historically, there's a long-standing history of prejudice against black quarterbacks. But in recent years, there's absolutely no evidence that there's any media conspiracy to promote the actions of black quarterbacks. But the bigger issue, I think, is, and that's an example of how Rush Limbaugh takes something, you know, he's on ESPN as a football commentator. He's talking about something that lots of football fans will debate, whether a particular quarterback is as good as some people think he is. But what Rush brings into it is he brings this bizarre racial angle, as well as this attack on the media, into what is just a run-of-the-mill sports discussion.
And Rush Limbaugh also has, as you document, sort of a long history of sexist comments and an interesting attitude towards women. Just sort of sum up what your argument is there.
Well, I think a lot of his sexism and his homophobia, you know, he's not always entirely comfortable with women. He has a primarily male audience. And he often brings in these kind of over-the-top attacks on women, insulting their appearance or... in the case of perhaps the most famous term he ever invented, feminazis, to attack feminists by comparing them to Nazi Germany, it's really a kind of extraordinary, over-the-top exaggeration. And one of the things I did this year, actually, I got I got some critics, actually, of Rush Limbaugh from the Jewish community to finally speak out and criticize his use of this term feminazi and the way it not just demeans women, but it makes this kind of absurd equation of what feminists are doing with what Nazi Germany did.
John Wilson, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Phone lines open at 217-333-9455, toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Before we go back to the phone lines, Don, I want to make sure that I get a sense from you, does Rush Limbaugh have a dog in this year's Republican presidential or next year's Republican presidential nomination? Does he have some candidates he's really warming to and some others he's down on?
Well, I think he is in some ways stayed out of it. You know, he doesn't like to jump too early into one side or another because he doesn't want to be wrong. He doesn't want to sort of alienate the people he supports. But he obviously is going to support someone who's very conservative. And, you know, I think he's going to try and avoid making the mistake he made in 2008, where he basically stayed out of it and allowed John McCain to take the nomination. He has been very critical of one candidate, Mitt Romney in particular, for coming out and acknowledging that global warming exists. And this particularly upset Rush Limbaugh, who has really been a deeply influential crusader against the existence of global warming and one of the major deniers that it, for the past 20 years, that there's any possibility that we have global climate change caused by humans.
Now, is that part of the 0.04% where he's wrong then? Or
No. he has been deeply influenced. This again is something where he would say he's absolutely right. And you know, there's been a shift, particularly in the last few years, where you've actually had in polls more and more Americans who believe global warming is a myth, even while the evidence for global warming has become stronger and stronger. And that's largely because of Rush Limbaugh and the influence he has had. And this is part of, I think, the critique that that I have of Rush Limbaugh is that it's not just a critique of conservative ideas, but it's a critique of the kind of anti-science, irrational approach to these. Because Rush Limbaugh is not attacking global warming based on any sort of scientific understanding. His basis for it is that basically that liberals supported it, so it must be wrong.
How about evolution? Has he gone out on there too?
He's been a little more vague on evolution. At times come out and questioned it a little bit, but he's never been very clear. It's nothing like the crusade he has on global warming. And again, he's very careful to try and pick his crusades well so that he doesn't completely alienate a lot of his audience.
Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Our guest is John Wilson, author of the new book, The Most Dangerous Man in America, Rush Limbaugh's Assault on Reason. Line one, Muhammad, you're on the air with John Wilson.
Hey, good afternoon. Let me play devil's advocate a little bit for Rush Limbaugh. I think a lot of what you're saying you're taking out of context. Rush has got a daily show, and it's much like a soap opera. The people who have been listening for a period of time know where he's coming from. And he's not racist one iota. I think that's absolutely wrong. And when it comes to anthropogenic global warming, man-caused global warming, when one understands the scientists at East Anglia were caught in outright fraudulent lies, one has to look at that seriously. I mean, how can you dismiss that?
Okay, thank you very much, caller. That's a really good point. And I think that is probably the main piece of evidence Rush Limbaugh uses against climate change is that one particular incident. What's your take on that, John Wilson?
Well, first of all, the scientists at East Anglia weren't caught engaged in fraud. You know, they were engaged in some discussions about the politics of global warming, certainly. But the other issue, I think, on global warming is it doesn't depend on just one or two scientists somewhere whom may, in someone's opinion, have not been sufficiently scientific in what they've done. It's a massive amount of evidence from across the world.
So let me get this straight. So if there are 1,000 scientists who work on an issue that all agree on something, and you find that one of them maybe cut a corner somewhere, somehow, you can't throw out the work of the other 999.
Right, and that's certainly true. Now, Rush Limbaugh, of course, doesn't actually care that much about the evidence. He has been doing opposed to global warming based on ideology and based on his opposition to liberalism. And he's even stated, you know, and this is the one of the few cases where he's actually brought in religion, that global warming can't be true because God wouldn't allow us to destroy the planet. And, you know, and I think he reaches that kind of religious angle just because he doesn't know any of the science and doesn't really have a grasp on the scientific evidence, and he's been proven wrong on the evidence over and over again over the years by Fairness and Accuracy Reporting, which did a lot covering him in the 1990s, as well as more recently. And so I think that really the point is not that global warming is incapable of being challenged or incapable of being questioned. I think it is in some ways, although the evidence is very strong for it. The point is that Rush Limbaugh doesn't do that. He doesn't engage with any of the evidence. He's not concerned about the evidence. This is purely an ideological issue for him.
And if I can follow up on that point before we go back to the phone lines, John Wilson, the key point you make in the book, and I think the thing that's the striking feature of Rush Limbaugh is he's a striking partisan, and he doesn't have the same standard for Republicans and Democrats. If you take the exact same set of facts and apply it to a Republican president does it or a Democrat president does. His response will be 180 degrees different. And I think you demonstrated that over and over in the book. And the classic case in point is Limbaugh's attitude towards war.
Yes. And when, for example, when the Clinton administration was proposing to go into Bosnia and get involved with that, Rush Limbaugh was wildly opposed to that and predicting another Vietnam and how terrible it was. And, of course, none of those predictions came to pass. But when it's a Republican president going to war, it's something that Limbaugh is wholeheartedly behind.
And opponents to war become traitors, too.
Hmm?
And the opponents to war in those cases become traitors.
Right. And I think that there really is that kind of part of the approach, because Rush Limbaugh does not deal very much or very well with foreign policy on his show. He is much more concerned about domestic issues, and he's clearly out of his depth when he starts talking about foreign policy. And that's why he relies more on these kind of partisan analysis to approach that. And of course, it becomes very difficult for him, as it has been for Newt Gingrich and many others, when dealing with Libya and these other issues. I think he really just sort of attacks Obama for being Obama, really, and for being a Democrat,
for being
a liberal. And that, I think, is the foundation of a lot of the kind of criticism that Limbaugh has.
I've often wondered, I just wanted to like to hear your thoughts on this. Let's assume that 9/11 had happened and there had been a Democratic president, and everything that Bush had done prior to 9/11 and shortly after 9/11 had been done by a President Gore or Kerry or whoever, Obama. And, you know, we know that basically Rush Limbaugh presented George W. Bush as some combination of Churchill and Abraham Lincoln, the way he handled 9/11. How do you think a Democratic president, having done exactly what Bush had done in the first year of office, would have been treated by Rush Limbaugh?
Well, I think there would have been an initial support kind of thing, because it would have been very difficult for anyone to stand up the kind of public response to 9/11. But I think there would have been, over time, many more questions raised about a Democrat, particularly among the conservative talk radio that dominates the corporate media. And you would have had a much greater investigation into what went wrong. Why did we fail to stop this? Why did we fail to get bin Laden? Why did we, all these other questions that really went away so much under people like Limbaugh, and that they had the advantage of being able to shift the conversation away from things that are uncomfortable for Republicans. It should have been asked, whether it was a Democrat or a Republican president, what more could have been done? What were the failings in the intelligence? What, all of these questions that should have been asked and really got ignored in a wave of patriotism.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. Our guest, John Wilson, author of The Most Dangerous Man in America, Rush Limbaugh's Assault on Reason. I'm Bob McChesney on WILL. Let's go to line 4, Coles County. You're on the air.
Yes, it's amazing how many Republicans are denounced by Limbaugh. Republicans who normally would be considered conservative by most people, if they even hint of moderation, just hint of a little moderation here or there on an issue, such as global warming or anything else, they're often denounced by Limbaugh. An example is, I think, Speaker Newt Gingrich is just one example. There are many other conservative Republicans who are denounced. Of course, John McCain, as you mentioned, was denounced by Limbaugh for year after year after year after year, even though it didn't stop McCain from getting the Republican nomination. But Limbaugh denounces just almost anybody with a hint of moderation as either a communist, liberal, or worse, a moderate. And he especially is strong at denouncing moderates. He claims that moderates are truly liberal, that are the moderate, people who call themselves moderate, are actually liberals in disguise. And it's interesting, by the way, if that's true, then the great majority of the American people are liberal, because certainly the polls show that a great majority of people in the United States call themselves either moderate or liberal. And if all the moderates are really liberal, then I would say that Limbaugh is admitting that the great majority of the people in the United States are liberal.
In fact, by following that logic, since he thinks most liberals are socialists, I guess that makes this country pretty left-wing.
Yes,
by his standards.
That's right.
Well, John Wilson, you make this argument in your book, and you've already alluded to it, that a lot of what Rush Limbaugh is all about is making the Republican Party extraordinarily more right-wing than that party that existed, say, 30 or 40 years ago, and that most people my generation grew up with.
Yes, and I think that analysis is right on target. The real enemy of Rush Limbaugh, aside from liberals, is what he calls rhinos, Republicans in name only. And he is really quite vicious towards any Republican that he perceives as violating these conservative principles. But most of all, what really sets Limbaugh off is when a Republican criticizes him. And there's been a whole cascade of Republican politicians who criticize some aspect of Rush Limbaugh and then have to apologize to Rush Limbaugh for daring to do so when they realize the danger that they've brought upon themselves. And there really is a fear in the Republican Party of going after Rush Limbaugh and questioning what he says. And his real aim is to move the party to the far right. And even if that means losing some elections, you know, he would much rather have a Democrat win than a rhino. He wants to have conservatives in there. And in many ways, what he's doing is really turning the conservative movement in the Republican Party into a minority party, into a long-term minority party, that he's bringing them so far to the right that they really are not going to get the majority of the American people's support. And really, Rush Limbaugh, in many ways, is probably going to be responsible for the re-election of Barack Obama in 2012 because he is pushing the Republican Party so far to the right that that even in a bad economy, Obama is likely to be the choice of people who are simply opposed to the alternative. And Newt Gingrich is a perfect example of the shift that's gone on in the Republican Party. He was someone who was on the far right of the party in the early 1990s and a big fan and friend of Rush Limbaugh. And today, you know, he is very much viewed with suspicion and criticism by Limbaugh because he is perceived as being too moderate, simply because not that Newt Gingrich has changed any of his values, it's that the Republican Party has changed, that it's no longer a pragmatic political party aimed at winning elections. It's a party of ideology, of Limbaugh's ideology.
Do you think, John Wilson, that liberals, progressives, Democrats, people who aren't in the audience for Rush Limbaugh, who might not listen to a lot of talk radio, do you think they don't fully appreciate just how prevalent talk radio is as a dominant medium in America, especially rural America, where there really isn't much journalism left because there aren't many newsrooms left in this country?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of liberals who listen to WILL and NPR and watch PBS, not because those are liberal stations or liberal programming, but because they're good journalism and sort of the last refuge of good journalism and real journalism left in the American media, especially in broadcast media. And they don't quite realize how much misinformation is out there, how many delusional theories are out there. And one of the things that I write about the irrationality of Rush Limbaugh is the amount of conspiracy theories that you'll find on the far right. And Limbaugh is a big proponent of them. One of his great conspiracy theories that he keeps promoting is the idea that Barack Obama is intentionally destroying the American economy in order to enhance his political power. And this is something he says over and over again. There's no doubt that he firmly believes in what is really an insane conspiracy theory, something that, you know, I don't think any liberal or certainly any sane liberal said about George W. Bush, but this is something being espoused by the leader of the conservative movement, and without any criticism from others in the Republican Party. And these kind of conspiracy theories are replete throughout talk radio. And some you can find people worse than Rush Limbaugh when it comes to craziness.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 4, Champagne, you're on the air with John Wilson.
This is line one.
Oh, okay, line one. You're on the air with John Wilson, too.
Good afternoon. I'm enjoying your conversation. Once in a while, I've had to hear some Rush Limbaugh shows of out of my control, but I've heard him screaming and hollering about the United States coddling crackheads and, you know, being too gentle on drug users. And then when he got caught with his Oxycontin crackhead or addiction, I didn't hear all of his explanations as to what his drug use was, but wasn't that quite hypocritical? And I'll listen to you off the air. Thanks. Well,
thank you very much, caller. John Wilson?
Yes, it certainly is an example of hypocrisy. What happened with Rush Limbaugh is that shortly before he lost his hearing a few years ago, and possibly because of it, he had been addicted to prescription drugs, and he had been engaged in illegal practice of buying these drugs and doctor shopping. He was buying them from his maid. He was buying vast quantities and utilizing numerous doctors to do it, and he eventually was brought up on charges and got away with a slap on the wrist. But he had sort of claimed that he hadn't engaged in criticism of illegal drugs and that therefore he wasn't a hypocrite. But he had, and certainly in the past, in the 1990s, he was one of these people who wanted a harsher treatment of people who break drug laws. And, of course, he hasn't really ever said much about this since then. He, after his drug treatment for his addiction, he came on the air, and he really has proceeded ever since then without changing his values, changing his ideas. He's never said anything about, you know, the drug war in America. Since then, he very much avoids the topic, and he certainly doesn't talk about what he did and exactly what crimes he committed. He really has been very silent about this.
You know, I sense whatever his strengths, self-reflection and compassion aren't really two of the things that jump out about him.
No, and that's one of the, and I suppose that's something you need to have if you want to be on the radio 3 hours a day and talk confidently about everything that's happening in the world. It does require a kind of ability to ignore what you've done in the past and what you've said in the past.
I'm sort of like playing cornerback in the NFL. John Wilson, our guest today, author of the new book, The Most Dangerous Man in America, Rush Limbaugh's Assault on Reason, just published this year by Thomas Dunn Books, part of St. Martin's Press. We've got about 8-9 minutes left if you want to call in. John Wilson, I wanted to ask you something I hear a lot, and I'm actually surprised we haven't had a caller to this effect, is that the programs that have emerged in the last decade, like Keith Olbermann's show, initially on MSNBC and now on Current, Rachel Maddow, even the Amy Goodman Democracy Now! Program, these are just the liberal and left-wing response, and they're basically two sides of the same coin. They're both basically throwing out their partisan propaganda. They're both just, you know, pulling it out of the air factually. Do you think that's a fair equation?
I don't think it's completely fair. There are obviously some elements to which you can see in programs like Keith Olbermann in particular that on Current TV now that have a resemblance to some of the fact, you know, they're not always a deep intellectual discussion of ideas. They rely on humor and superficial discussion sometimes. They can be partisan-minded. You know, they do share some elements with Rush Limbaugh, but I don't think they share the fundamental irrationality. And particular, some programs I think we need to distinguish. I think Democracy Now! is fundamentally very different. It's about having different guests. It's about having a serious journalism. Shows like Rachel Maddow. I mean, there's a fundamental difference between kind of Rachel Maddow's thoughtful discussion of issues and her deep desire to bring in Republican politicians whenever she can. Often she can't get them to come on her show. With Rush Limbaugh, who's someone who refuses to have guests except for an occasional Republican politician, who simply refuses to engage in the debate of ideas, who really does not want to be challenged or questioned. Who doesn't want to have journalism or discussion of facts on his show, where it is all about Rush Limbaugh. And I think that's fundamentally different in terms of the style of the debate from what is going on with some of the few progressive media.
Do you think that the way to respond to Rush Limbaugh and Fox News for liberals or progressives is to try to basically do what they do but from the left? Do you think that is that is the appropriate and smart way to sort of mobilize your base, galvanize them, gin them up, and get them fired up to go out and win elections?
Well, I think that we need a diverse group of voices on the left, just in many ways as we have some on the right, that we need to have some loudmouths on the left. We need to have some people who are firing up the troops, as well as the kind of more intellectual debates that you'll find on your show and many others. I think we need a variety of those voices. I don't think we need the kind of irrationality and hatred for the opposition and dismissal of opposing ideas that you find on Rush Limbaugh and many other places on right-wing talk radio. So I don't think it's necessary to go to the extremes that the right does in order to bring an audience, but I think it is important for progressives to recognize some of the factors that made Limbaugh successful, which is use of humor, the kind of appeal to a broad audience, and these kind of the use of a charismatic host. These kind of things are not necessarily bad things to have on the left. The problem is not that progressives lack people who can do these things. The problem is that progressives lack an institutional structure of media that allows their voices to be heard.
In the matter of humor, John Wilson, you've mentioned it now a few times, and from what I can tell, and I haven't heard enough of them, but I've read transcripts and what you've shown, a lot of the humor is sort of ridicule of liberals and Democrats and sort of bully humor, for lack of a better term. And it seems like it's very antithetical to what you say, the Stewart and Colbert types of humor. And I'm wondering, is the nature of current right-wing politics immune to that type of hip humor, ridiculing people in power? And the reason I ask this is, you might remember about 5 years ago, Fox tried to do its version of a Colbert show or a Stewart show late at night, and had sort of trendy young people, you know, making jokes about liberals. And it was maybe one of the most entertainingly bad programs in the history of television. They just couldn't make a joke. And is there something built into the political culture that points in that direction?
Well, I think there is certainly an element of that. And yes, Rush Limbaugh's sense of humor is not my sense of humor. It is a very, in my view, kind of stupid sense of humor with, you know, basically it's things like calling Michelle Obama Mucho, these kind of vaguely racist and utterly juvenile kind of insult humor. The difference is, I think it has to do with the market, is that you have a lot of comics who tend to be progressive, who reach a much younger audience, like Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert. There really isn't that on the Republican Party. There's not a group of young conservative comedians that are really very active. There's not a big audience among young people for these kind of conservative ideas. So it's very hard for them to develop these kind of shows. But I think eventually they will. I think they'll, because there is this big market that's available for them to reach, and there's a big interest in doing that. But I think progressives certainly need to continue that. I think some of the best political commentary on the progressive side comes from comedy shows and comedians like Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart. And I wish there was more serious attention among young people to an intellectual debate of ideas, but at the same time, I really appreciate that kind of humor, and I enjoy that humor.
John Wilson, we're nearing the end of the show, so just quickly, just wanted to know, how has the response been to your book so far?
I really haven't gotten a huge response. It's selling a little bit, but certainly not as much as I had hoped, and I think it's been very hard to actually get a lot of attention from either the right or the left. It's been very hard to get any attention from talk radio and sort of competitors of Rush, because I think there is a fear on the right of any sort of criticism of Limbaugh. But I think there's also, sometimes I worry about this on the left, a kind of instinctive hatred of Rush Limbaugh, where there are many progressives who despise Rush Limbaugh and don't particularly feel a need to think through the reasons why. They don't need to read a book about why they hate Rush Limbaugh. They don't need to understand who he is and what his ideas are. They just dismiss him out of hand, and I think that's a mistake. I think progressives really do need to grapple and respond to
and criticize these leaders of the conservative movement.
On that note, John Wilson, I think that's a good description for why people should look at your book. I want to thank you so much, John Wilson, for joining us today in Media Matters.
Thank you.
I want to thank Kyle Kroha, my engineer, and Melissa Trentz, my producer, for their great work. I'm Bob McChesney. We'll be back in 167 hours. We've got an interview next week, which I just recorded with former Labor Secretary Robert Reich. I think you'll enjoy it for Labor Day weekend. I'm Bob McChesney, everyone. Have a wonderful week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Expect mostly sunny, dry, and pleasant weather for the next couple of days. Temperatures will be in the lower to middle 80s through the period. Tonight it'll be partly cloudy with a low around 54, Monday mostly sunny with a high near 83, Monday night mostly clear with a low around 59, Tuesday mostly sunny with a high near 82, and Tuesday night mostly cloudy with